there is no such thing as objective language in this conflict, because objective means two different things to two different sides.
For reporters covering the war in Gaza, choosing the right word is a difficult, daunting task. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the media resound with reports of downed planes, we offer a news consumer's guide for consuming that coverage.
The impulse to think, is our air traffic system breaking down? Have the regulators gone to sleep? Are the pilots drunk? That is an impulse that often comes through the initial reports, which is worth resisting.
And when the news is dominated by mayhem, sometimes humor is the only way to cope.
Things are so f***ed up in our world that the two happiest places on Earth right now are Germany and Cleveland.
There's more coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Thursday, monitors at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 detected shrapnel-like holes on parts of the wreckage. That's the first official evidence that the plane was downed by a missile. On July 17th, the airliner was shot down as it flew over the Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine. All 298 people on board were killed. Although an official investigation into the crash is yet to begin, in the court of international opinion, Russian separatists who had previously downed Ukrainian military planes in the region were clearly the culprits. But the Russian media is waging a counter-campaign, offering alternative theories for the crash.
To sum up, the plane diverged from its usual flight path. Secondly, it passed directly over a war zone.
A source in the Russian aviation industry claiming President Putin's plane may have actually been the target of the attack.
The pro-Russian rebel commander making this bizarre suggestion that MH17 was loaded with people who were already dead.
Novelist and screenwriter Michael Edov lives in Moscow. He says Russian media outlets are just doing what they've been doing.
The last year has seen an extermination of free speech and free press in Russia. One after another, respected news sources were sort of hollowed out and replaced by propaganda machines that speak with a unified voice. And that voice is largely the voice of the Kremlin. But what happened with flight MH17 is, for the first 48 hours or so, there were clearly no signals coming from the Kremlin. And all these news outlets, willing, ready and able to amplify the official line, were really left without an official line to push. And so what you saw after the plane went down was just this frantic scrambling for conspiracy theories, anything that would lay the blame on anyone other than Russia and Russia's surrogates in the eastern Ukraine.
From the moment the plane was hit, there were some striking inconsistencies in the Russian media.
Well, the most fascinating part of this coverage is that it involves so much scrubbing of the reporting that all these news outlets have done before the crash. Because you have to realize, for months now, the official Russian media have been acting essentially as a recruitment tool. They were lionizing the separatists and reporting breathlessly on their heroic deeds, which included reporting on them acquiring surface-to-air missiles and taking down Ukrainian planes. So after the crash, we were treated to the sight of news channels like RT, the former Russia Today, and Life News, frantically backpedaling and going as far as to take down their previous reporting on this to show that, of course, now the rebels were not capable of such a thing because they did not have the missiles that we had reported on them acquiring a few days ago.
Tell me a little bit more about the role of the internet in this one.
Russia has very good internet coverage. It's a very internet-savvy country. But strangely, it's not helping the information get out. Basically, everyone's free to choose the version of the events, any events, that they are most comfortable with based on their previously held worldview. And Putin has been incredibly successful in creating this worldview of Russia as a besieged fortress, beset on all sides by enemies. So when you couple that with this endless availability of conspiracy theories, you have people grasping at, frankly, idiotic explanations just to avoid dealing with the fact that they might be wrong in their assessment of things.
There was a classic, though, one that I have seen in virtually every propaganda war where extreme demonization of the enemy is required, and that is killing babies. Russians, Channel One interviewed a sobbing woman who said she was a refugee from Slavyansk and that the Ukrainian forces drove out the pro-Russian insurgents and then staged an execution. And the woman was forced to watch as Ukrainian soldiers took her three-year-old and nailed him to a board. And no one interviewed by reporters subsequently has even heard of this story, much less witnessed anything like it.
That's correct. The point is to make the other side less than human. And again, unfortunately, it works. The Russian media have been acting as a recruitment tool for volunteers to cross the border and go fight in Ukraine with the separatists. One of the more independent news outlets recently did a fascinating series of interviews with the volunteers who went there to fight. And most of them are retired soldiers, retired policemen itching for action. And when asked what made them get up and leave their families and children and go fight this skirmish, all of them said that, you know, they saw the sobbing children on television and they wanted to go and stop this.
Gleb Pavlovsky, who's a former Putin political consultant and Kremlin advisor, said that the news programs have so overheated popular opinion that this is becoming a problem for Putin because the system cannot be wholly managed. Do you think that Putin can walk this back, or is this spun out of control?
Basically, the tail is wagging the dog now, because as Pavlovsky mentions, the Kremlin's rhetoric is actually much more measured compared to the insane fever pitch television rhetoric. And of course, that gets fantastic ratings. So at this point, Putin and his people are, in a way, hostages to the more extreme voices on television purporting to support them. They're egging each other on, and I'm really fearful that that's the beginning of a chain reaction that brings about something, you know, reminiscent of a fascist state. And I can only hope that this tragedy somehow manages to cool things down, because the people are buying it. That's the scariest part.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Novelist and screenwriter Michael Idov. On Wednesday, two Ukrainian fighter jets were downed near the Russian border, not far from where the Malaysian airliner fell. On Thursday, investigators from France and the UN were searching the north of Mali for the wreckage of an Air Algérie flight that crashed carrying 116 people. Lately, the news resounds with havoc from the heavens. So before it gets any worse, we thought it was time for a corrective. A breaking news consumer's guide, if you will, for plane crashes. James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and, as it happens, a pilot. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Brooke.
Let's talk about finger pointing. We saw tons of that, and we always do. Let's start with blaming the aviation organizations.
Precisely because commercial airline crashes are so rare. Most of the time, it's something that nobody has thought of because all the normal predictable threats people have figured out. The other is that in most of these crashes, people don't know for a long time what went wrong. So in all the finger pointing, there's a background fact that it probably is not the thing we're thinking on that first day.
The International Civil Aviation Authority has been reported to make the rules about where you can fly, but they say that's not their responsibility. It's the responsibility of the sovereign member states to advise other states of potential safety hazards.
Most airline companies are not in a position to do sort of political risk intel for the world as a whole. They can't tell you where things in Guinea or Mali or Somalia are heating up now. That's what the international bodies are for. So most of the time, there's agreement on these things. And we're seeing now, as they put it, the edge cases, where Ukraine says one thing, Russia says another, the FAA says a third, and the ICAO, the international body, says something else. And they're all saying, well, you should have foreseen this. No, you should have foreseen it.
What about blaming the airlines? They were flying in the wrong place. They were doing it because it was quicker. They could save gas.
So most of the blame in this latest case has involved Malaysia Airlines, which I personally feel has been unfairly singled out. I say unfairly because most airlines on the day of that flight were going straight over Ukraine as they had done before, which is the way things normally work in the airline world. If airspace is not prohibited, it is presumptively safe and legal. Because some airlines decided not to do that. I think Air France was one of them, a few others. The ones that did were presumptively cutting corners, but actually they were doing the normal thing, and the others, for their own reasons, had decided not to do that.
Another thing you often hear is the likelihood of pilot error.
Yes. When it comes to small airplanes, when they go down, it's almost always pilot error. With the airlines, their standards for pilot training are so thorough, and they have so many redundancies and checklists. This is usually not the case. And actually, there have been only a few notable exceptions. The Asiana flight that crashed on landing in San Francisco Airport a year or so ago, that was rudimentary pilot error. There was a tragic commuter plane flight going into Buffalo a few years ago where the two pilots reacted exactly wrong to what they should do when they encountered icing. The Air France loss over the South Atlantic a number of years ago, that also seems to be a very sophisticated kind of pilot error where they got into some kind of storm, their autopilot failed, and their training was such that they responded in the wrong way.
Okay, now you're making me feel like there's a lot of pilot error.
I'm naming you the three flights I can think of as I scrape through the reservoir of commercial airline disasters. And usually it's not pilot error because these people are better at their jobs than most of us are at ours.
When you're watching cable news, they have a lot of experts that tell us what we need to know.
By definition, anybody they have on the screen is an expert about something. And especially you get this six experts in a box approach that the CNN in particular, but others have done too. Some of them actually are, some of them are not. And the ones that usually mark themselves to me as being the real experts are the ones who are saying, we don't really know about that yet. It'll take a long time to be sure. And they may, through reverse Darwinianism, eliminate themselves from the box over time.
Speaking of boxes, there's always a great emphasis on the black box, the magic box that holds all the answers. Does it?
In some cases, it does. Now that the Ukrainian separatists have turned the black boxes over to the Malaysian authorities, I don't think they're going to tell you very much, if anything, about Malaysia 17, because by all indications, it was flying around perfectly normally, and then it got blown up. And there's nothing in the black box that would tell you anything other than at time X, it was flying normally, and at time X plus 1 second, it was falling out of the sky. In some cases, they tell all. I think in this most recent case, they're likely to tell very little.
What clues can we glean from who was on it? That's something that's done after a flight.
We have seen cases where if there's any airplane which has any connection to the world of Islam or the world of upheaval, we try to think, is there anybody on there who might be Islamic in any way? And you very much saw that after the Malaysian 370 flight, where, oh, there's somebody who was from Iran. Might this have been a clue? Hard facts you come up with on this first trawl, they're more likely to be misleading than leading.
Back in September 1983, a passenger plane, Korean Flight 007, was shot down by a Soviet interceptor while en route from Anchorage to Seoul. It crashed into Soviet airspace. All 269 passengers were killed. First, the Soviet Union denied the incident, then admitted it, and then Soviet leader Yuri Andropov claimed the plane was a CIA spy plane. Reagan said it was an intentional act of barbarism. Tensions mounted between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. There have been several parallels cited between this event and Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. So when you're hearing the arguments of governments, what do you take away from that?
Yes, there's a set of three disasters that are linked together this way that I think of for this political slash aviation interchange. There would be, of course, the Korean Air 07, the shooting of an Iranian passenger airliner by a U.S. warship, the Vincennes, I think in 1988, and now, of course, this event. Each one of these three cases of actually shooting down the plane reveal the murkiness of command and control operations, either in the tactical or the grand strategic level. The tactical level, there were Iranian outbursts at the time, understandably, that the U.S. had intentionally shot down this plane because of the enmity between the U.S. and Iran. But this was a tactical-level mistake on the warship, a very terrible one, but not a higher-level one. For these two episodes of first Soviet and then Russian-related forces apparently shooting down passenger airplanes, it will be about the fearfulness of the former Soviet Union around its periphery, of the way its air defenses were on hair trigger, and the Korean airline flight was just skirting the periphery of the Kamchatka Peninsula and Siberia. In this latest case, it will be about what the people who shot this missile knew and whose authority they were acting on or under. We don't know that. I assume we will. And my guess at the moment would be some kind of miscalculation of thinking it was a military plane or something else, but we don't know.
Going back to the Vincennes. In the immediate aftermath, there was an outrageous U.S. government cover-up. There were maps that were altered when they were released to the public to suggest that the U.S. Vincennes was in international waters when it was in fact in Iranian waters, that the plane was descending in an attack stance when in fact it was ascending. In the initial presentation by Admiral William Crow, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the government offered a completely falsified account. Izzy Stone said, "All governments lie." Is that something that the news consumer should keep in mind?
All governments apparently are willing to lie, conceal the evidence, falsify the evidence or whatever, because the plain fact of shooting down a civilian passenger airliner is so horrific on its face, they want to deflect responsibility for that. I don't believe in any of these cases it will prove to have been intentionally malicious murder. But in all cases, I think it will be a combination of recklessness and miscalculation.
So if you could offer some advice about what a news consumer should take seriously at this point and what not when consuming news about these kinds of tragedies, what would it be?
Something like 100,000 planes take off each day in some kind of commercial flight and land safely each day. And it is horrible when something goes wrong with them. But I think the impulse to think, is our air traffic system breaking down? Have the regulators gone to sleep? Are the pilots drunk? That is an impulse that often comes through the initial reports, which is worth resisting.
And what about the role of extraterrestrials or the Bermuda Triangle? I think they may have both come up in the discussion of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370.
More from our experts at 10.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic and a pilot. Coming up, when it comes to Israel and Gaza, it's not just what you say, but the words you use to say it. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The conflict between the Israeli military and Hamas rages on. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, more than 800 Palestinians have been killed. As of Friday, Israel has lost 32 soldiers and at least 3 civilians. And each side uses very different words to tell its very different story. As the Vienna-based International Press Institute found, even seemingly innocuous language can alienate or anger one side or the other. So with the help of 3 Israeli and 3 Palestinian journalists, it set out to identify those hot-button words and phrases that the media throw around and create a glossary that offers context and more neutral language. The results are assembled in a handbook called Use with Care. Naomi Hunt, editor of the glossary, says they knew the task was pretty nearly impossible.
There is no such thing as objective language in this conflict because objective means 2 different things to 2 different sides. And so the best you can hope for is to sort of describe how different groups might respond to different terminology based on their own experiences and their collective memory and so on.
Were there any particular words that were especially fraught?
You know, I think almost every word was fairly fraught.
Give me an example. Read your entry on caught in the crossfire.
Okay. Reports occasionally use the expression caught in the crossfire when referring to people who are killed during an exchange of fire, which implies, first, that the victims were civilians, and, secondly, that the killing was accidental. Until it has been clarified whether the action was purposeful and whether the person killed was really a civilian, it is better to simply say they were killed.
I marveled at how you tiptoed your way through words of death, execution, murder, liquidation, neutralization, targeted killing.
Any word to say that you killed somebody that implies either the guilt or innocence of the victim or the guilt or innocence of the person doing the killing is going to be loaded for someone else.
Yeah, and if you use the word murder, you're saying one thing. If you use the word neutralization, you're saying another. Generally, you're into killed or assassinated.
At most, assassinated for a political figure.
I also want you to read the entry called Measures.
Measures. There is a Palestinian view that the word measures, used, for example, as part of the phrase economic measures or security measures, minimizes actions such as blockades or raids imposed by Israel on Palestinian civilians. Journalists should explain what measures were taken, what justification was given, and what the response was on the other side.
That one could really sneak up and bite you if you were writing on deadline.
That, I must say, was one of the words where it surprised me that the Palestinian journalists found that word troubling. The same with the word development. The Palestinian journalists felt quite strongly that the word development has a positive connotation of improvement when often it is used in the context of construction in the East Jerusalem or the West Bank that might involve, for example, the destruction of Palestinian orchards or homes and property, which for them, therefore, is clearly negative.
And so the advice of the handbook?
Was to use the word construction.
There were certainly some words where even the handbook concedes no alternative or neutral language could be found.
That's right. The separation barrier is an example. The separation barrier was put up between Israel proper and the West Bank, as well as Israel proper in Gaza, and is basically a wall at which there are checkpoints preventing the flow of people between those territories. It's an extremely sensitive issue. So there's a view on one hand that it's a security fence or that it's a security barrier, but there's Palestinian view that that implies that all Palestinians are violent criminals who need to be kept away. On the other hand, some of the Palestinian terms for the separation that you do see in some Palestinian media, like apartheid wall, for example, are deeply offensive to Israelis who believe that there was a legitimate reason to install the barrier in the first place.
So you call it the separation barrier.
That was the alternative word that we arrived at following a lot of discussion and a lot of back and forth, and which I think probably made nobody happy, which was our only indication that it might be the best one.
It is kind of interesting that when you try to shear words and phrases of their political meanings and of their emotional contexts, you end up reducing the amount of information they provide. I mean, you either can choose them telling one half of the story or the other half of the story or less of the story altogether.
I wonder if we're reducing the amount of information. I think certainly the amount of poetry, the alternatives that we provide, I wouldn't say that they're the most riveting use of language, but that's precisely because it's the emotional baggage of words that is offensive to people on the other side. I believe our project on the Israel-Palestinian conflict is about 3 years old at this point, not very long. But even in that small time span, we see that the same conflict comes up in a similar shape over and over again, that the communication between the two sides, if anything, seems to be worsening and not improving. And so this guidebook, we hope for what it's worth, that it will help people who are interested in at least following along as they read the news, because it helps you to see how the language that you're consuming also reflects a certain perspective.
Naomi, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Naomi Hunt is a senior press freedom advisor at the International Press Institute based in Vienna and editor of Use with Care, a reporter's glossary of loaded language in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We will link to Use with Care on our website. Go check it out. The issue of semantics is very much on the mind of Jody Rudorin, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, who explored it in a recent piece titled, In Gaza, Epithets Are Fired and Euphemisms Give Shelter. Jody, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks so much for having me.
Israeli author David Grossman wrote about the propaganda war over the Palestinians way back in 1987. In his book, The Yellow Wind, he wrote, a society in crisis forges for itself a new vocabulary, using words that no longer describe reality, but attempt instead to conceal it. Could you assess that observation from a perspective 26 years later?
Well, some things just continue. I mean, on both sides, there's dehumanizing language and there's euphemisms that I think make the constant conflict and the violence kind of go down easier, as Grossman described.
Those who are slain who are non-combatants are sometimes called the uninvolved?
Yeah, Edgar Keret, another Israeli novelist, told me about this. There is a Hebrew word for civilian, and if a civilian is killed in Israel, it's always used. It's Ezrachim. But then he talked about this phrase called uninvolved, which is not always used for Palestinians, but often. He said, you know, all we can say about this person is that they're not shooting at us. He said, this person is not a child who wanted to grow up and play the piano and not a woman who wished for bigger breasts. It was just someone who wasn't shooting at us, someone who was uninvolved. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really powerful the way he put it.
You mentioned in your piece Ayelet Shaked, a member of parliament, who cited a 2002 article and posted it on Facebook.
Right. It's a good example of how much is new and how much is old, right? Because she got all this criticism for making this post on Facebook. And in fact, it was an article that was from a dozen years ago. It talked about how the whole Palestinian people were the enemy. And it defined Palestinian children who think of themselves as martyrs. It called them snakes. And it also said that all their mothers should be killed. And it went viral. And so what's interesting to me about that is the way that the social media networks have kind of put this propaganda war on steroids, because things just happen so much faster. People like Ayelet Shaked and other kind of leaders and officials, they're not phrasing their own talking points in the same formal and maybe careful way that they used to, because they're playing on these different platforms where everything is conversational and quicker. So that's one aspect. The other is that the social networks have just opened up the field, right? So now anybody can be in this propaganda war. It's being fought by people who are in New York or in London, firing off missives and characterizing data. Little themes or memes develop without necessarily anybody in charge or anybody trying to dictate what the talking points should be anymore.
What kind of memes?
There are hashtags on Twitter, one called Gaza Under Attack and the other one called Israel Under Fire. People are doing creative mashups in video or in Photoshop that mix Hollywood thrillers with footage of Israeli or Palestinian leaders or Israeli or Palestinian strikes on each other or things like that. There are these videos that the Hamas is putting out and videos that IDF is putting out, and they both are kind of styled after trailers of Hollywood thrillers. And I don't know, if you didn't pay too close attention and you just saw the explosions and heard the thundering soundtrack, I'm not so sure you could tell the difference.
The last ground invasion of Gaza happened 5 years ago, which was a big 5 years for social media. You write that in 2009, a soldier in the military public affairs unit, Aliza Landis, paid for a WordPress account on her own credit card.
There was tons of stuff going on social media. She was realizing that the IDF was totally absent from that conversation. And so she just said, this can't be. And she kind of went to her superiors and said, can I please post this thing on YouTube? Whereas now they have 40 people working just at Interactive. So now they're really right in the game.
Hamas is also trying to harness social media, but it's encountering some roadblocks.
Right, because Hamas is characterized as a terrorist organization by the United States and by other Western countries, Twitter and Facebook have blocked some of its official accounts. So they've still got some that are going, and I think they have other proxy accounts there. Individual leaders have their own Facebook pages and things like that. But they have definitely been hampered. But they're doing their own thing, too. I mean, they had a video that they posted from their interior ministry that advised supporters on how to post to Facebook and other social networks and told them what to say.
This is the do's and don'ts video.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of the do's and don'ts that they had were sort of similar to the do's and don'ts that I get from the New York Times. Don't use all the 140 characters because if people want to retweet you, they need space. Things like that. Don't write about things that are not right where you are because you'll lose your credibility. And then some of the other ones were a little more specific, like don't put up footage of masked gunmen at close range because they'll shut you down, or don't show rockets being launched from a civilian neighborhood because Israel might attack it, and always add innocent civilian after the name of every dead person, and definitely post pictures of dead people.
As for how the U.S. media are contextualizing the conflict in Gaza, Nimer Sultani, who lectures on law at the University of London, took note of the repeated use of the phrase once again in many, many American and Western stories about the conflict in Gaza. He said, repetition is equated with futile death. I guess what he's saying is by saying once again, you've judged and dismissed the conflict over again. Have you noticed frequent use of the phrase? Have you used it yourself?
I don't know that I've used the phrase once again, but I've definitely written repeatedly that this is the third Israel-Gaza battle in the last 6 years and tried to explore questions of will this time be different or not?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is true that a lot of what's happening in Gaza has happened twice before in the last 6 years, and reporters should say that. It's important to the story to have people know that. It's context. Now, is once again a loaded phrase that has a sort of this implication of futility? It might.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably say it in a more neutral way, I guess. It relates to some complaints I hear from readers, which is what started everything. No matter how much background you put in a newspaper article, there's always someone who thinks you didn't go back far enough, right? And that because this is always seen as a tit-for-tat thing and it goes back forever, people want to begin the conflict, the specific thing you're writing about, wherever they want to begin it. And I sometimes joke that every article should include a paragraph that says, Abraham had two sons, there was Isaac and there was Ishmael, because it seems like that's how far this goes back.
Jody, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jody Rudoran is the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief. Her recent article is titled, In Gaza, Epithets Are Fired and Euphemisms Give Shelter. Foreign reporters now inside Gaza choose their words with care as they cover the war. But that's not the coverage the Gazans themselves are consuming. Shireen Tadros is Middle East correspondent for Sky News. She's spent years living among and listening to the people in Gaza. We called her to explain what they see and what many of them have come to believe. Shireen, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks.
So where are Gazans getting their information?
Well, the majority of Gazans really have very little access to information. At least 200,000 or so Gazans that have left their homes are now sheltering in hospitals and schools, wherever they can. All they have is word of mouth. Some people we've seen at hospitals just waiting for loved ones that they haven't heard from in days to turn up at the morgue. So it's really grim. But of course, others who are still at home and do have television sets will be able to have access to mainly Hamas-affiliated channels, a lot of propaganda on these channels. that will tell you about how many Israeli soldiers were killed and captured and so on. There's also the radio that tells you constantly where strikes have taken place, how many people are killed, and so on. But because there's such a huge electricity crisis, you're talking about just a few hours of electricity every day, there is also a very limited amount of time that people can spend gathering that information.
So both figuratively and literally, they're really in the dark.
Precisely. Part of the psychological war that Israel wages on the Gaza Strip and has done so for many years is controlling the information that they get. So we've seen broadcasts on television and also on the radio be interfered with by the Israeli army. We were watching the other day a speech by the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh on TV, and suddenly the Israeli army shield comes up on television. You know, it's a way to show the Palestinian population here that they are in control. And likewise, on Wednesday, a colleague of mine was in the car listening to the radio, and suddenly the broadcast was disrupted. And then we heard a voice of someone saying, if you're a terrorist, beware, take cover, we will come and get you.
Are there any independent actors working to disseminate information on social media or otherwise, or is this principally a Hamas media?
There is certainly a lot of independent actors insofar as citizen journalists, doctors, people who have just taken it upon themselves to document and report what they're seeing, not necessarily reporters or activists. And you see that on social media all the time. But I think the general Palestinian television and radio stations are hijacked by a Hamas narrative of what's going on.
So what is the message being put forth on Hamas TV?
The message from Hamas, coming certainly from their media, is that we are winning this war, that the resistance is bearing fruit, that Israeli soldiers are paying the price, that Israeli citizens are paying the price. Constant propaganda videos showing militants or fighters firing rockets, them getting out of Gaza underwater and crossing over the sea and then making it into Israeli territory. And they have basically a split screen most of the day where they show a live feed from the main hospital. And, you know, it's completely unedited. You see people being, you know, taken into hospital with missing limbs. Once we saw, you know, someone with a missing head, dead bodies all the time.
Do people feel Hamas TV is a reliable source?
I don't think that Palestinians see it in that way. I think they understand that this is propaganda. They see this rocket fire and this fight by Hamas as a fight on their behalf. Just like Netanyahu talks about the need to protect and defend the right to protect Israel and Israeli citizens, Hamas use the same language. They are using the rocket fire to fight back and to protect their people and break the siege.
So there's no openness to the Israeli talking point that Hamas, by launching missiles from the basements of hospitals or from schools and so on, is actually using the population of Gaza as human shields.
I think for anyone who actually has been in the Gaza Strip, you will see how controversial this claim is. This is one of the most densely populated places in the world. Everything is next to a school or a mosque or a building. Add to that the fact that Hamas cannot have a military base. They would not allow for Hamas to build an official headquarters. But of course, they have used certain areas for protection. The international community have made a big point about that being possibly a war crime. But you know, I think there's a lot of context that goes around this idea of Hamas using human shields.
Every time you hear an Israeli official on the media, what they say is, look, we sympathize. They should just tell Hamas to stop firing and this could all be over.
Once again, the context is completely missing in that. And this is not in any way to condone what they're doing, but just to explain the context behind it. You know, the idea of all they need to do is stop the rocket fire, and then Israel will stop the bombs. And then where does that leave the Gazan people? Once again, under an Israeli siege, once again, having everything from toothpaste to medicine trickling in, once again, living in essentially an open-air prison.
Thank you very much, Shireen.
Thank you.
Shireen Tadros is a reporter for Sky News. She joins us from Gaza. Coming up, the funny side of the news. Sort of. This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Enjoying the show so far? We'll be the first to admit it has not been exactly uplifting. It's been a violent, sad week. Sometimes the only way to wring anything positive out of it all is through the transformative power of comedy. In Israel, Eretz Nehederet is a show of social and political satire watched by 1 million of the country's 8 million people. In this sketch, it skewers foreign policy cliches by imagining them being taught to kids.
Do you want to play Who Are They to Preach Morals? Okay, Italians?
Help the Nazis.
The French?
The Vichy regime.
And the Turks?
Massacre the Armenians.
Incomplete answer.
And the Kurds.
Norway?
Killed all the salmon.
So what do we tell the world?
Don't preach us morals!
Sharon Teicher writes for Eretz Nehederet. He says the staff doesn't fret too much about balance.
I think we are quite balanced, but being in Israel, well, we have 8 million people over here. It's 8 million opinions. Basically, we have to say something, and we say it.
Here, The Daily Show is funny, but it actually informs a lot of people about the news. They get information and comedy and the backgrounds of the stories in the same package. Is that true with Eretz Nehederet?
The Israeli audience consumes hours of news during the day. So they really come to the screen with a wide common knowledge about what's going on. So we're not telling the news, we explain the news.
Can you give me an example of how you've done sketch comedy on violence in the past?
Well, in the past military operations, we did a sketch in which military correspondent for the news was counting the deaths on both sides like it was a football game. It was a hard sketch, but it made a point.
You often have actors or actresses playing Israeli officials. How do the actual officials feel about that?
Well, some of them might get offended. Some of them got offended after the show. But most of them realized that being on our show just made the public know them better.
Bad publicity is better than no publicity?
In politicians, yes.
Do you ever have conflicts within the staff sometimes about what to joke about? I mean, they say that comedy equals tragedy plus time, but in your case, we're talking about no time.
Well, we do sometimes argue about things in the writer's room. Most of the time, if we feel that something might be too harsh, sometimes it's a sign that we have to do it because we're saying things about very important issues in the Israeli society. Well, most of the times we make people laugh, but sometimes we really get to change some views about issues, and that's very fun work and a very important one as well.
Is there one that you can think of that you think actually did have that kind of impact?
Yes, it involves the army. I wouldn't talk about it right now because of the irrelevance during wartime. But in the Israeli budget, lots of money goes to the Israeli army. It looks like the most important thing about Israel is security and the army, like there's nothing else important in Israel. And we made some sketches about where the money really goes. It made something.
How do you know that it had an impact?
Nobody says that the Israeli don't need an army, but they look a bit deeper into the issue, and the media did discuss it and started asking themselves questions like, should the army really cost the amount of money it really takes from the budget?
Sharon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Sharon Teicher is a writer at Eretz Nehederet, the most popular sketch show in Israel.
I used to be a lefty, but I got disillusioned.
Over here and over there, and especially lately, the news has been basically soul-sucking.
Go on vacation for 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Things are so f***ed up in our world that the two happiest places on Earth right now are Germany and Cleveland.
You must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on, says the narrator of a Samuel Beckett novel. It's a comically desperate, desperately comic line. Surely now is a time of desperate comedy, of comic desperation. The show must go on. The show can't go on. The show goes on.
Now, obviously, there's no way to completely escape this. But we can at least take a sadness break, featuring stories that sound like they would end violently, but don't. In our new segment, yeah, we'll take it.
Peter McGraw, co-author of The Humor Code, posits the benign violation theory of humor. A violation, he says, refers to anything that threatens one's beliefs about how the world should be, something threatening, unsettling, or wrong. But to be funny, it must somehow seem benign or safe. Violations, he says, become safer and funnier with physical distance and time. But our most emblematic comedy, as rendered by Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, and now John Oliver, seems in no way distant or safe.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait, you're not going to really do a comic take on the death penalty, right? It's your second episode. I haven't even decided if I like this show yet. Well, okay. So let's do this then. Before you turn this show off, there was a YouTube video this week of tiny hamsters eating tiny burritos. And it's as magical and as uncomplicated as you think. And if you make it to the end of this story, I promise we will watch it together. Okay? But you have to stay with us. Okay, so the death penalty.
Lord Buckley, a hipster comedian some 60 years ago, said in a bit on the H-bomb that it is the duty of the humor of any given nation in times of high crisis to attack the catastrophe that faces it in such a manner as to cause the people to laugh at it in such a manner that they do not die before they get killed. Would anyone believe Jon Stewart if he still said, which he doesn't, that he does it just for laughs?
We'll start tonight in the Middle East, where Israel...
What? Israel isn't supposed to defend itself?
Oh, yeah, if Mexico bombed Texas, will we exercise...
What other countries held to the same standard as Israel?
People that want to destroy our terrorism?
What is
the matter with you? It's the only democracy in the Middle East, you turd!
Self-hating Jew?
That was weird.
There is an increasing urgency to the comedy of Stewart, Oliver, and Colbert, an edge that no amount of potty and penis jokes can dissipate. And yet, it's still really funny. It's truly a marvelous magic trick, this seamless weaving of silliness and moral indignation. Cervantes wrote that the most difficult character in comedy is that of the fool, and he must be no simpleton that plays that part.
Think about it, folks. How can we rich trickle down prosperity to everyone else unless we have all the money first? Our cup must filleth before it runneth over. Clearly, Congress hath underestimated the size of my cuppeth.
Stephen Colbert's blowhard alter ego with his assertive idiocy and crocodile tears actually embodies our cynical, heartless politics. And he's probably the funniest.
We will have complete coverage of both of these stories on tomorrow night's show. And I'm being told we do not have a show on Friday nights. Okay. Oh, thank God. Those are really depressing stories. So let's turn to a lighter story, child refugees.
Do you know what I like about comedy? Colbert told Parade magazine. You can't laugh and be afraid at the same time of anything. If you're laughing, I defy you to be afraid. If you're like me, you grab at the chance to laugh at the horrible. It's sweet relief to see that, in fact, the world has gone mad. But for me, that relief doesn't last long. Maybe it's a matter of character. Albert Einstein had to flee the Nazis, and yet he could still insouciantly observe that two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the universe. Marilyn Monroe expressed a similar view when she said, "Ever notice how what the hell is always the right answer?" But she couldn't shrug it off. I think it's funny that Peter McGraw, who cooked up the benign violation theory of humor at his University of Colorado Humor Research Lab, also co-directs its moral research lab. It could be that the only way to hold on to the laughter is to make moral choices, take moral action when the TV is off. And though they don't say that exactly, our madcap Mahatmas won't let us forget it. Show. On the Media was produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Mira Sharma. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippin. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.